This is Talkback Gardening with Troy Sincock on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
It most certainly is, but I'm not alone. Joining me is Brett Draper, horticulturalist and garden centre manager, filling in for John Lamb this week. One more hour of the program to go, and we have got lots to talk about. We'll be talking about bulbs in just a moment, Brett, and of course roses as well, as the big National Rose Trial Garden.
Yes, and so there's people choice judging is going on in the National Rose Trial Garden this weekend. So Merv Trimper will be joining us a little bit later in the program. He's the coordinator of that, and he'll be explaining exactly what's going on and how you can get involved in the actual judging.
I've actually visited Merv's house when I was the roving reporter for the breakfast show, and I thought, oh, this will be whatever it is. I don't know anything about this. And I couldn't believe when I went to park the car, you could really tell which house was Merv's. You didn't really have to look for the number. It was abundantly clear that someone that loved roses lived there. And they weren't just in the front, they were in the back. There was every available space Merv was growing roses. So I'm looking forward to hearing from him today.
That'll be fantastic.
Absolutely. And coming up this hour too, I have two Gardening Australia April edition magazines to give away at random. So stay by the telephone if you're not planning to call this morning. The weather today in Adelaide, early rain, then a shower or two, top of 20. For Sunday, an early shower or two and 18. Sunny again on Monday, top of 21. In Mount Gambier, rain easing in 17. In Renmark, rain easing also in 18. 21 and showers for Port Pirie. For Port Lincoln, showers, a possible storm later in 20. Whyalla, a shower or two, 21 degrees. And 21 and rain for you in Broken Hill. A reminder, Brett's advice is of a general nature and shouldn't be taken as personal, professional advice.
Talkback Gardening with Troy Sincock on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, even though we're in autumn, it's time to actually start thinking about your spring flowering bulbs. And right now is peak planting time for spring flowering bulbs, and there's lots and lots of different varieties on the market. But some people are a little bit apprehensive about what to do or what to select and how to select them, and then obviously how to prepare the soil before planting. So I thought it's a prime opportunity to look at all of those sort of things. And the person that's going to help us do that is Deborah Griffin. Now, Deborah manages one of, Australia's, if you like, largest growers, wholesalers and distributors of spring flowering bulbs, and supplies many of the garden centres and retail outlets across this state and Australia for that matter. Deborah, when we go into a garden centre at the moment, we often see a whole range of spring flowering bulbs that are there, and they range from things from, you know, daffodils to tulips to jonquils to hyacinths to ranunculi. I mean, the list is absolutely endless. You work for a company that actually grows a lot of these and actually distributes them right across the state. Are you able to tell us a little bit about that process and you know, what's involved with that?
It's a very exciting time, actually, for Van Berkel Distributors is a family-owned business. And it's our 70th anniversary this year. We've been growing and selling bulbs for all of those years, and it all started with Henk and Len van Berkel, who came from Holland in 1941, and they established themselves in Mombulk, growing predominantly tulips and hyacinths, which they had done quite successfully in Holland. So we're now up to our fourth generation Van Berkel. We've traditionally been growing and selling bulbs all of that time and supplying to customers, garden centres all over Australia. So Trenton Cottage, who I manage, wholesales to nurseries and garden centres all over Australia. We've got Garden Express, which is our retail arm of the business, and mail order. We also have got and distribute and grow Woolamai Pine.
Oh, right.
Which we got the growing rights for that worldwide, both for Australia and, you know, as I said, worldwide, probably about 15 years ago or so. That's a very exciting part of the business. And we also do a lot of packing and distribution of bulbs. There's a lot of families that have been growing bulbs for many, many years. And unfortunately, some of the younger members of that generation are not necessarily taking up the reins and following in their family's footsteps. David wants to grow especially hard to get bulbs, but also things like dahlias and a lot of bulbs we're building and growing that side of the business up in Healesville.
That's wonderful. I mean, 70 years of business in the fourth generation, that's an incredible story, Deborah. That's just amazing. And the fact that you're able to, if you like, to secure some of those lesser known or lesser grown varieties now and almost save them and still have them available for people to actually grow is just a wonderful thing to do. And our focus this morning really is on your spring flowering bulbs. So those ones that, you know, you see in sort of late August, September through to early October. And I guess the most important thing is, it's all very well, they look very pretty in their packets, but you need to obviously think about how to prepare the area to plant them, because that's probably a very important thing that you get that right to have success later on in the year. What would your advice be to people to prepare the soil in preparation?
Usually by now, if you're establishing new garden beds, probably back in February, March, you're preparing the soil, putting in, turning over some well-rotted compost or aged manure, even with a cup of complete bulb fertiliser, every square metre of soil you do. You turn that over, get rid of all the weeds, make sure it's well drained.
Drainage is a good point. It must be well drained. Yep.
Because, and have the garden bed slightly raised. The problem is if the soil gets waterlogged, it will cause the bulbs to rot when they go dormant. So they won't be any good for the next year. So it's mainly establish the garden beds, remove the weeds, dig in the fertiliser, mulch the soil, and, then start planting. But not quite yet. We have to wait for the soil to get a bit colder, and my rule of thumb is start planting from Anzac Day onwards, and that depends on your environment and weather. Some environments are still, they're experiencing warm weather. Pop some fertiliser and make sure you never use fresh manure.
Right.
Because that can burn the bulbs.
So a well-rotted manure or a compost, or even if there is a suitable, are there specific bulb fertilisers, for instance, that you could use, or is it more of a general
there
purpose?
Specific bulb fertilisers, but you can use also a complete fertiliser.
Okay.
And so long as, the garden bed's free of weeds and that all helps because they're not competing for the nutrients from the weeds.
Yep.
And that's important with any plant, of course.
A real opportunity here, if you're planning to plant bulbs or hadn't really thought of it, now this is perking your curiosity and you've got some questions. David is in Crafers. You need some advice, David.
Deborah, when I receive my bulbs, my tulip bulbs, they're of a large size and they flower beautifully. My problem is, how do I continue this for subsequent years? What do I feed them to keep that bulb size that I want to create? Mine seem to fall away and become quite small. I'd like to know what I can feed them to get them up to a decent size.
Well, the main thing that you need to do with every bulb, not just tulips, is once the bulb has flowered in spring, you need to feed them with either a bulb fertilizer or a general complete fertilizer. You need to allow the foliage to die back completely. Do not cut the foliage back, because the foliage gets the and takes in the nutrients from the sun and helps grow the flower in the bulb for the following year. Now, once you've done that and all the, and I'm talking about the foliage being brown and just falling away, with tulips in particular, along with hyacinths, you then can lift the bulbs and store them in a cool, dry environment, away from the weather conditions, away in somewhere safe where vermin can't get to them. And doing that each year when you plant them, they should increase in size and be well looked after to ready to plant for the following year.
Yeah, is there? And I've always thought this is this helps, and it may this could be complete. I could be completely wrong, but does it also help to why after flowering, if you were to use say a soluble liquid, you know, flowering type fertilizer on the foliage, does that have any a help as well in building the bulb, or is it really just a complete garden fertilizer which will do the job?
It can, yes. You can. I believe you could use that. I've just been always, to be honest, I haven't used that before myself, but I cannot see anything while the foliage is still green. It's going to take in the nutrients quicker with a soluble one.
Correct. Yeah. As I was thinking, if you were to do both, for instance, you would get almost a double whammy in being able to build those bulbs ready for next year.
Yes. And it's really important that the flower has got every opportunity to grow and develop inside the bulb, and they need the sunshine. I mean, you can have shade, they can be planted in shade as well, but they need a good deal of sunlight throughout the day to help develop that flower in the bulb for the inside the bulb for the next year.
Deborah, we were talking a little bit earlier about if bulbs, for instance, you've got soil rather that's got poor drainage. If you can't improve the soil that's there, are they suitable for pots? Could you grow them in pots, and would that solve the problem? And then, you know, what is there any, I guess, drawback from growing them in pots at all?
Not at all. You can grow them in pots. There's so much variety now. Aesthetically, there's huge amounts available. My advice would be not to pick a dark coloured pot or a black pot,
right?
Because the sun will attract and warm and heat up that pot. That's just a personal preference, because it tends to maybe not cook the bulb but make it very, very hot, and bulbs like the cool. So definitely in pots, there's no drawback. Some bulbs, such as there are summer flowering, but the very tall gladioli's, you'd have to have a pot suitable that it wouldn't tip it over. But you can grow, and one of my favourite things to do is, and it's a really fun exercise for kids and for everybody, is to layer your pots with bulbs. So you've got different frames, so you can do a layering exercise of planting different types of bulbs with also different time frames, because with bulbs there's, and say for example daffodils, you have early, mid and late flowering in spring, and that applies to a lot of different bulbs of timing, and you can have a lot of fun with layering a pot.
Kay and Mount Barker might be looking to do exactly that. Is that right, Kay? You were thinking about popping bulbs in pots too.
That's correct, yes. I've only got a small area, so I was just trying to work out how I can go about it, because I do like my bulbs, but I do find they multiply so much, and then you've got to try and dig them up, and I'm in a retirement village, so that's a bit hard sometimes. Your body's not able to do all that hard work.
My advice, because again, there's a couple of varieties that would be, for example, tulips and hyacinths, that you have to lift from the ground every year anyway, and being in pots, that makes it easier. And they also, the one thing is though, with the hyacinths and the tulips, they need to be chilled in your fridge for about 4 to 6 weeks beforehand. But they're ideal.
You know, you talked about you need to be able to chill tulips and hyacinths, you know, prior to planting. Why is that? Why do you need to do that? Why is that important that you need to actually do that?
With those particular bulbs, it helps build the bulb strength.
Right.
And they need, the one thing is they, you have them in a paper bag, for example, in a fridge crisper or in a, or a separate fridge to what you would normally use. You cannot have them in with any vegetables.
Right.
Because the vegetables emit a gas that will, similar to, say, for example, you want to ripen a avocado, you place a banana with it, and that will emit a gas to help ripen the avocado quicker. Well, this type of thing will, the gas from vegetables can kill the flower that's developing in the bulb, and then it's rendered useless. So it is very important. Yes, you do have to chill them, and it does build the strength, and it cools them down enough to then you plant them. And look, a lot of the bulbs, most of spring bulbs prefer to be planted about 12 weeks ahead of flowering time. So you buy, that's why the spring bulbs are available now, getting in preparation for spring.
The bulb calls are coming in thick and fast, Deborah, so we need your advice. John in Hawthorne, your jonquil is growing too tall, huh?
That's correct. I've got a 15-metre bed of early cheer jonquils, and with the heavy weight of the flowers and the fact that the stalks are 600 to 900 long, they flop over. Is there anything I can do to shorten the length of the stalks or stiffen them up a bit more?
That is a very tricky one, because they're obviously loving what you're doing, and they're, I mean, look, there are plant supports and bulb supports that you can put in. Other than, I mean, I think they're growing very well and obviously very healthy. I have to say, I'm not sure what you could do other than, I mean, what I've always done with jonquils, because they do tend to grow very prolifically and you get lots of beautiful flowers. I tend to cut them for flowers before they get to that stage and
enjoy them that way. But I think, Deb, I think your suggestion about support, like a bulb support or a plant support, maybe in the area prior to them growing, so they actually grow up through the support,
yes.
If you're not going to cut them, for instance, might be the solution there, just to actually, you know, particularly when the flowers themselves get moisture in them, they do get very top heavy, and that might be a way that, you can keep them from flopping over.
It's Jane in Marden now. You need some suggestions for bulbs, Jane.
I'm interested in bulbs that you plant, little ones, tiny little sort of star-shaped ones that you plant them, and then each year after year they spread throughout the, you know, the base of the garden there, throughout everything.
That sounds like the little spring stars. And, I mean, there's a few different varieties. There's a light blue and there's a moonlight. And they're little purpley-blue flowers, and they multiply quite rapidly. They bulb, they're one that you can just plant and forget, and they'll keep on spreading and coming up every year.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Now we've got Andre from Windsor Gardens. You need some help with your bulb planting, Andre.
Yes, I've started to grow gladioli, and I was wondering, when do I plant the bulb? And do I leave the bulb in all year, or when do I take the bulb out?
Well, gladioli, the bulbs don't start becoming available till June. They're a summer flowering bulb. Mm. They need to be planted, as I said, 12 weeks before, so by September or thereabouts, and it can be a bit later. And you can leave them in the ground. They do need support. I tend to leave them in the ground year after year, so long as I let the foliage grow back, die back, and also fertilise them. You will find occasionally some of the bulbs might rot if it gets too wet. But, yes, and there's a huge range of colours which you'd be aware of.
So they can be left in the ground all year round, can they? I thought they were like a daffodil, put it in and take it out.
Well, the daffodils you can leave in all year round. I've left all of my gladiolus. You can lift them, as with any bulb. You can lift them each year if you choose to, but you can also leave them in the ground, providing they're in a good drainage and And that's what I have done for many years myself. And yes, you might lose some, but that's, you've got two alternatives. You can lift and you can leave them in the ground.
Thanks, Deborah. ABC Talkback Gardening. Troy Sincock here with Brett Draper, horticulturalist and garden centre manager. Our special guest is Deborah Griffin, a bulb specialist. A number of texts, just quick fire for you, Deborah. Firstly, Anne just texting to say that every year in the UK, it was a must to put hyacinth bulbs in a jar of water to grow. That was a regular occurrence. Tracy wants to know, are there any bulbs that are less toxic to dogs?
I'm not aware of any.
On every packet now, it's required that if they're toxic to humans and or if there's a problem with animals such as Lilliums with cats, etc., it's noted on the label. I would, before you purchase bulbs to go in your garden, check out the packaging. It always has the warnings on it.
One last quick listener question for you, Deborah. Do commercial bulb growers raise and chill their bulbs in bulk?
Yes, they do. And look, there's various growers over the all over the country, depending on what type of varieties. A lot in Victoria and Tasmania. But, you know, the growers, yes, they do. They do. Depending on they harvest, and this spring we've had a late harvest because of all the rain last year, and we'll be having probably a later harvest with we're moving into the potato season for harvesting, etc., and that will be late again, all from the rains from last year affects what happens this year.
Mm. Well, Deborah, look, time is starting to beat us, I'm afraid. It's been a wonderful session to be able to talk about, and I've got lots of questions that I was going to ask you to go through,
yes.
But that'll have to be for another time. It's certainly we would like to thank you very much for providing all of that sound advice to our listeners, and I'm sure at some stage we'll need to get you back in to talk about, because there are lots and lots of questions that are coming through and lots of people are wanting to know what they can actually do. So with that, we'd like to say thank you very much for your time, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. Happy to come back at any time to talk.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Deborah. That was Deborah Griffin, manager of Trenton Cottage and a wholesale grower, packer and distributor of bulbs, supplying garden centres and retail outlets right across Australia, and was at your disposal for the last half hour. So I hope you got your questions answered. Linda, you're our next caller. You're looking to move a rose.
Good morning.
Yes, I have to transplant. I put a climbing rose in, and then I put other plants in front, and the plants in front have completely outgrown and smothered, taking all the light away from the climbing rose, and I think it's going to rot or something. So I have to move it.
Right.
When's
the
best time?
Look, the optimal time to move any rose is during the dormant period. So late June, July, and probably not beyond the end of July, really. Maybe early August if you're lucky. That's the absolute optimal time. If the rose is really suffering now, and you know you think you need to get it out sooner, you can do that. It just might interrupt its flowering and establishment a little bit for next season. But ultimately, you need to look for the warmest, sunniest position that you can find, because they really do like the warmth, where there's less competition, particularly root competition around there. They can be planted into a mixed bed, but you just need to make sure there's sufficient space that's around there. The thing will be with your climbing rose, if it started to climb onto a structure, that you'll need to cut that back, particularly if it's attached to the structure or growing through it. You'll need
no,
to cut those.
No, that's why I want to move
okay.
it.
Oh, good,
it
before
really
it does that.
It got going.
Yes.
It's just been struggling to keep alive.
No, that's terrific. And so, look, generally, if you're moving them during the winter months of the year anyway, you would do your normal pruning, and that's when you would actually move them. But as I said, if you do it now, just give it a light prune and pop it into either a pot or its new situation, and plenty of sun.
Linda, thank you very much for your call. Jocelyn's in Mount Barker. Are you going to the football today, Jocelyn?
No, I'm not, but isn't it exciting?
Absolutely. What's it actually like in Mount Barker right now?
Everybody thinks it's pretty exciting, I think.
Except for you, who's staying in the garden.
Exactly.
How can Brett help you?
Well, I'm interested in peonies.
Mm-hmm.
And when to plant and how to treat, and are they perennials or annuals?
They're perennials. They will die back at certain times of the year. From memory, they're available sort of late, or during the winter period, late winter, you know, so sort of through that July, August period. There might be some varieties which might be available now. The important thing with your peonies are that they are a cool climate plant. So in Mount Barker, you'd probably, you know, you'd have a good chance or a much better chance than, say, maybe down on the Adelaide Plains. But you would want to try to avoid, you know, hot blasting sort of afternoon sun, that sort of situation.
Right. Yes.
And they generally, we generally recommend that you apply lime to them, area to actually improve the actual pH, to improve the flowering of the actual peony itself.
And what about in pots?
Yeah, look, you definitely could grow them in pots, but a bit like Deborah was saying with the bulbs, you would need to use a terracotta or an earthenware pot so you've got better insulation. Because you want to make sure that you keep the root zone as cool as possible. And pots, if it's a large enough pot, you know, that you can get a good sized root system established, that would be ideal. And obviously not too large that you can't move it. But if it's a pot, you could actually then move it. You know, if the situation wasn't quite right, it was a little bit too warm, for instance, you could move it to a bit more protection. So pots would be very well suited.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your call, Jocelyn. Gerald is in Paralowie. You've got something troublesome going on in your garden.
Yes, weeds.
Oh. Right, okay. What sort of weeds?
Well, I'm not sure what it is, but it's like it comes up every spring and summer, and it's very aggressive in that it comes up everywhere. Now, I pull it out, but I don't know how to describe it. It's like a flat plant. If I let it mature, it gets yellow, little tiny yellow flowers. But
is it got, what sort of foliage does it have on it, Gerald? Is it is that fine green foliage or is it broader? Or
no, it has like round leaves. Someone said it's like a succulent almost.
Right. Yeah. It could be when you break it up. Has it got that juicy sort of feel to it? Has it the foliage?
Well, I don't break it up. I just put it in a rubbish bin, but...
No, but yeah. there are a type of... there are several types of summer annual sort of weeds that come up during that period of time, and I think they're related to the Portulaca family, so they've got that succulent-y feel to them. Does it have a single tap root that it grows from, or has it got multiple roots?
Yes. No,
does have
it's a single.
Yeah, single tap root that's there. Yeah, you're right. They are quite difficult to control at times. And, you know, it is time-consuming, but your best method, rather, is hand removal of those. And if you can get them in one clump and you can twist them and pull the whole tap root that's out there, similarly, you could hoe them out. You could use one of your weedicide type sprays, but you would need to do that very early in the season when they were young, because the more they get established, the harder they will be to actually knock off. And if they were quite young plants before they had an opportunity to establish their roots, you could successfully use one of your organic weed killers, because they work exceptionally well at burning the foliage that's there, but they don't kill the root zone. So if you can get onto them while they're small before the roots, you could use an organic weed killer, which would be ideal and help you be able to control those. But whatever you do, try to get them out before they actually flower and set seed, because that will be compounding your situation for future seasons.
Your fig is going like crazy, Anne.
Yes, it is. It's Anne in Bendigo, formerly of Lamoureux. So thank goodness for ABC Listen and John's newsletter. I can still get the best gardening advice.
Oh, you're a great person, Anne.
Thank you. Yes, I have a self-sown fig tree that is about 3 metres high. It's produced figs for the first time this year.
Yes.
Early in the season, it had like 6 huge figs. And I said, oh, well, I'll leave it because I'll maybe fruit next year. And I went to look at it the other day thinking I'd trim it back, and it's actually produced a full crop of figs.
Mm, fantastic.
At this time of the year, but is it too late? Should I remove that fruit?
It depends what sort of size they are, Anne. Have they developed?
They're very tiny.
They're very tiny, are they?
Yes, they are.
Yeah,
yes.
Look, it's... Again, it comes back to the, you know, almost the question about this year about, you know, tomatoes and things not ripening. You could be one of two things. If you want to take those off and that energy will then go back into the establishment and the structure of the actual plant itself for next season, then I would certainly recommend that. But right. On the other hand, there is a chance that you may still get some of them to set fruit. So you could, I guess, right. you could go one of two ways. You could maybe remove 2/3 of what's on there and leave a third and see what happens.
Yep.
And then that way, that takes a lot of the pressure off of the tree without it setting back too much. And you might still get some late figs, and fantastic if you do. And if you don't, well, you don't. That's sometimes just the way it goes.
Sure.
But on the other hand, you know, if you feel that you would like to make sure that the tree is not stressed in any way, then I would be removing them, and it won't have any harm.
No, the tree's going berserk.
Yeah.
And yes, tomatoes haven't ripened very well this year at all. I'm actually looking up recipes at the moment for green tomato pickles.
Yeah, there's plenty out there. And can I just say, I think John actually might be having the tomato survey next week.
That's right.
So so listen, you know, people that have had tomato issues this year, he'll be summarising what's been happening.
That'll be excellent. I'll definitely be listening. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks very much for your call. It's 17 to 10. Troy Sincock here with Brett Draper, horticulturalist and garden centre manager for John Lamb. I have got two Gardening Australia April edition magazines to give away right now. They're going to be taken at random. So all you have to do is call, cross your fingers, close your eyes and hope for the best.
Yes. Now, well, it's time to change the program a little bit and talk about roses. And this weekend is the autumn rose show at the Botanic Gardens, and right alongside where the rose show is being held is the National Trial Garden for Roses, and the coordinator of the National Trial Garden is Merv Trimper. And now Merv joins us now to talk to us about the People's Choice Awards and how people can get involved. And good morning to you, Merv.
Good morning, Brett. Good morning, Troy.
Morning, Merv.
Now, Merv, I guess people will have seen, if they've driven past the Botanic Gardens, particularly there on Hackney Road, quite a large rose garden that's there. That garden is actually the National Trial Garden. Can you just explain to us a little bit about the purpose of that garden and why it's there?
So the National Rose Trial Garden is part of the International Rose Garden in the Botanic Gardens. It's just a small section where we trial new varieties of roses. So these are roses that haven't yet been released to sale for the public, over a two-year period. And we have a group of assessors, as we call them, and they range from people who are obviously rosarians, but also people who are involved in the nursery industry. And then also, separate to that group, we have a group of perfume assessors as well who assess the fragrance of the roses. So we have between 30 and 50 new varieties of roses in the trial each year.
Mm-hmm.
And one weekend of that two-year period when we trial the roses, we have the opportunity for the public to come along and make their selection of the roses that are in flower. And today and tomorrow is that opportunity. And we have 25 of the trial that are in flower this weekend, and people can select their top five in their order according to whatever criteria they wish.
Right, that was going to be my next question. Do you have to have experience in judging, or can anybody come along? What sort of things?
Anyone can come along, and it's a bit like saying, well, you're going shopping, and I want to make a choice on what product I'm going to buy. So you use your own criteria. So some people will go for colour, some people will go for fragrance, some people will go for vigour in the rose bush, because obviously if the rose looks as though it's diseased, you may not want to buy it. So it's really is their own preference to how they would purchase it.
Now, Merv, I was just going to say that. So when people come down and they do that judging, how is that does that provide, what does that feedback into for the growers? Or
So we tally up all the scores.
Yes.
And firstly, from this weekend, there is one person who wins prizes to the value of $1,000.
Oh, wow.
And that is selected according to how people vote. So if, 100 people select rose number 21 as their number one vote and that gets the highest score, well, then if you've got your order as, like, number 21 followed by number 24 followed by number 7, the correct order according to how people have voted, well, then you get that prize. So, so from the point of view of the public, that is obviously useful to gain that. And the prize is made up of rose products, fertiliser, rose advice, nursery.
Fantastic.
Products.
Yeah.
That makes it up. From the point of view of the trial garden itself, we give feedback to the breeders, the rose breeders, and probably more than 50% of the roses that we have in trial have been bred overseas. So those breeders have agents, which are nurseries in Australia. So we give feedback to them on which rose has won the People's Choice. And that is a special award, apart from all our other awards that are given in the normal assessment by the if you like, the semi-professional assessors.
Yeah, and so Merv, when will the results be known of the judging?
So we announce the results usually in a week or so, and get in touch with the winner. The rose, which is judged the People's Choice Award, we then release publicity on our Facebook page and our web page on that rose. Mm-hmm. It may or may not be named.
Right. Okay. So we won't. So, if it's not
and,
named,
and it may. And it may, or may not actually be available to purchase yet from the nursery, because obviously with roses there's a 1 to 2 year lead-in time for the nursery to produce them, and so the roses that we have in the trial, being brand new, not released roses, sometimes are named during the trial and released for sale, but when they're put into the trial, they haven't yet been released. So the nurseries use that feedback. In fact, a couple of years ago, we had a rose that won the People's Choice Award, and the nursery that had the rights to sell that rose hadn't released it, and they had decided from their own internal trials that they weren't going to release it. But as soon as it won the People's Choice Award, they said,
"Oh wow,
right, this is a winner! I'm going to get some sales out of this."
So they power to the people.
so they decided to release it, and in fact, that rose. I believe the Botanic Gardens is going to plant a whole bed of that rose. They're continually rejuvenating the rose garden.
Fantastic.
And they're going to pull some roses out, and they've decided to use that rose in a bed of roses in a prominent position in the garden. So
yeah, so Merv, the People's Choice judging is on today and tomorrow from 10 until 4 p.m.
And the rose show is on at the same time, although today I think it only opens at 11 because they're still judging. So the rose show is in the is held by the Rose Society of South Australia.
Yes.
The autumn show, where the blooms are cut and exhibited. So it's like the best of the best blooms that
it's a competition, that Rose competitive
Society
competition.
Yep. Competitive competition. It's free to enter. Both these events are free to enter if you're wandering in
Terrific.
The garden and
yep.
And it's not raining at the moment, so it's quite nice to wander in the garden and get all those wonderful fragrances from the wet plants, not only the roses, but all the other plants in the Botanic Garden.
And if it did rain, you could duck into the row show and have a look at the show and then duck back again and finish your judging.
Exactly. And there are people, Rose Society members, if you've got questions on growing your roses or want to decide on a new variety of rose that you may want to plant and say, oh, I want a white rose that is, a metre high and flowers prolifically and is disease resistant, what one do I plant? And we can give that advice quite freely here today too.
That's fantastic, Merv, yeah. Well, listen, thank you very much. I hope you have a very successful day and the weather holds out for the most of the day and lots of people come down and take the opportunity to be part of the People's Choice judging.
Yep, thank you. And I always have the motto, if everyone could smell a rose every day, the world would be a fantastic place, wouldn't it?
It would be.
Absolutely love that, Merv. Thank you so much for being part of ABC Talkback Gardening. Merv Primper, the coordinator of the National Rose Trial Garden of Australia. I reckon we can sneak in a couple more calls, Brett, if you're all good to go. Sandra is in Hackham. A question about fertiliser, Sandra.
Yeah, hi, Brett. Thanks for filling in. I have a small... medium-sized pot as a wicking bed.
Right.
And I want to give my lime tree some Charlie Carp today.
Right,
I'm just wondering, do I put it over the top of the soil, or do I put it into the pipe where the, down to the roots?
Yeah, has it been established into the pot for a period of time? Would the roots be right down to where the wicking material is, or?
It's probably been a good 3 months since we put it in the wicking bed.
Yeah, I would pop it over the top then in that case, because ultimately any material that is absorbed will then, if there's any left over, will make its way down into the reservoir anyway. But it will be, but because they're more surface rooted, it'd be more beneficial to pop it over the top and water into the root zone.
Oh, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for your call. Alexandra in Highbury, how can Brett help you?
Good morning, Brett. Good morning. I have a Grevillea firecracker, I think it is.
Right.
It's been planted out for about a year. As it's a very healthy looking plant, but where the flowers, I believe the flowers should be on the very tip. Each time something develops and it browns off and it droops. And I just have not had any flowers across this plant.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if I'm thinking, is it an NPK imbalance? Do I need to be prompting it to flower?
Mm-hmm.
Just have no idea. I've been watching it. I've trimmed, nipped the tips off in the hope that that might prompt it. No, nothing yet.
Okay, so apart from that, does the plant look healthy, or is it always?
Yep. Looks brilliant.
Looks brilliant.
It's really
okay.
Healthy. Yeah, nothing. I can't fault anything with this plant except for the fact that the tips droop. First half centimetre of the tip on every edge of this plant is drooped.
Yeah, look, I'm wondering two things. One, whether it's something to do with the soil itself, whether the soil structure's not quite right, and maybe, you know, it at times might get maybe some wet feet, for instance, and that might be causing that. We often find that tips of plants, particularly, you know, or root systems that get a little bit waterlogged at time will cause them to die back. But the other thing is, if it's lacking some nutrient that's in the actual soil itself, that could be causing the issue as well. So maybe, you know, look at using a specific native fertilizer. Most of your grevilleas are sort of late winter, spring flowering. That's their main flowering time. So now would be a pretty good time to actually put that on there, and just have a close look at the plant also, and just make sure that there's nothing else going on, like some mulch, for instance, that might be touching the trunk of around there, or something that might be damaging, you know, that sort of thing that might be causing those tips to actually die back. It's a little bit hard. It's a little bit of a curly one, that one. I'm not sure, you know, exactly what might be going on, but I think just a bit of observation and maybe looking at applying, you know, a well-balanced food might be the answer for you.
Thank you very much for your call, Alexandra. In Meningie, we'll try and sneak in Sharon.
Yes, good morning, Brett. I have quite a large apple tree that has woolly aphis.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what to do first, whether to spray or to prune, given that it needs a significant cutback anyway.
Yeah, I'd be looking at controlling them as quickly as you can, to be honest. The reason being is they can colonise and be very hard to, when they get in large numbers, they can be very hard to remove, and they can actually do quite a bit of damage to the branches of the trees as well. You'll find that they'll cause, you know, nodules and welts to form, and they can do, you know, a lot of disfiguring of the actual plant. So I would look at controlling them pretty much straight away before you prune. The best control normally is your oil type sprays, like eco oils, pest oils, those type of things. Probably a pest oil is probably a good one to look at using. And you will need to thoroughly spray them, because the woolly aphid have got that woolly coating on the outside, which is almost like a protecting layer. And you want to make sure that you're able to get the oil right through that onto the actual scale, because that's actually, or the aphid rather, because that's how it actually kills them. They're soft bodied, how it gets, how you actually get the material on them. So you really need to spray that quite thoroughly. Well, after you've done your pruning activity, you would then need to spray the tree rather thoroughly again. So making sure that you get the trunk and all the branches around, you know, right around 360 degrees wherever possible. Because if you don't and you leave any there, particularly if they're protected in the crevices of the bark or something like that, they can come back quite quickly. So get onto it as quickly as you can.
Thank you so much for being the last call of the morning. A very busy program on ABC Talkback Gardening. Brett Draper, thanks for being being here for John Lamb today.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, Troy.
What are you planning to do with the rest of your day?
Well, I need to get into the garden, but I want to check out a couple of these gardens that are part of the Landscape Festival, because normally, as I said, you can't get an opportunity being private gardens to have a look, and any opportunity to have a look at some of the fantastic work that has been done by our local landscapers, designers, and just to get ideas. It's just fantastic. I think it's a great way to actually get ideas.
Sounds like a wonderful way to spend the day. Well, thank you again for being here for the last hour and a half.
My pleasure.
I really appreciate it.